8, pretty good cloud cover. 50 degrees Racine, 48 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Holding in my hands a book that gave me a tremendous amount to think about and on all kinds of different levels, professionally and personally as well, a book called The Abundant University, Remaking Higher Education for a Digital World. This is written by someone who, in a sense, lives and works in the world of higher education, Michael D. Smith, who is J. Eric Johnson Professor of Information Technology and Marketing at Carnegie Mellon University's Heinz College of Public Policy and Management in Pittsburgh. In this book, Professor Smith is calling all of us, including those of us who live and work in higher education, to try to be, in a sense, brave enough to imagine a different sort of world of higher education, one which is far more inclusive. And even if that remaking of higher education might mean, in a sense, the elimination of some of what we maybe hold most dear about what our current colleges and universities are all about, it is Michael D. Smith's contention that with all that has come about technologically speaking, that has altered so many avenues and vistas of our modern society, there is no reason to blithely assume that higher education will not and should not also change. And it could, in fact, change in ways for the better in terms of society as a whole, and in particular making higher education and its abundance available to a far wider swath of the public. It is an intriguing notion and one I have really appreciated exploring in this really interesting book published by the MIT Press. Again, the book is titled The Abundant University, Remaking Higher Education for a Digital World. And Professor Michael D. Smith, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate that. Most of our listeners know this. Probably you should know this as well, that my full-time job is actually as a associate professor of music at our local liberal arts college. So that's what I was sort of hinting at in my introduction and saying that this book was very striking to me on a couple of different levels. And I should also hasten to add that you don't have to be somebody who teaches in higher education or even is particularly interested in higher education to find this book really, really fascinating. So I just wanted to be upfront and clear about that personal context for me.
Oh, well, thanks. Actually, that makes this discussion all the more interesting, honestly, to get your perspectives on what you're seeing.
Absolutely. So the title of the book, The Abundant University, is chosen quite deliberately, although at a glance, of course, I don't think it will make a lot of sense to people. And of course, the point is to get people to open up the book and explore it further. So we should maybe point out a framing of this topic that you use that I find quite intriguing, namely that our current world of higher education, our system of higher education, which in so many ways has largely been in place for centuries, is based on a model of scarcity. And so your title, The Abundant University, proposes a different kind of higher education. Let's begin, though, with that notion of a model of scarcity. In what way do you see our current higher education system built on scarcity?
Well, I'm arguing there's three key scarcities that define, in many ways, a university's power in the marketplace. The first is the powerful universities are the ones who control access to the scarce seats in the classroom. The second is powerful universities control access to the scarce faculty experts. And the third is powerful universities control access to the scarce valuable credential. And in many ways, you know, that's what's defined our structure of power in the university. Now, what I'm trying to argue in the book is what digital technologies do is they make scarce things abundant, right? So think about Spotify and compare it to the CDs and cassettes that you and I grew up with, right? When we were growing up, the only music you had access to was either what was being played on the radio or what you had in, you know, on CDs. Now, for $10 a month, we can get access to all the world's music at the touch of a fingertip. And not only that, it's personalized to us, right? That's abundance. What I'm trying to argue in the book is that I think we're going to see digital abundance coming for higher education. I think it's going to change how we do work. And I think that we in higher education ought to want to embrace that because of what it's going to mean for the students who are excluded from our pricey campuses today.
Right. And by the way, one thing leapt out at me in the preface of the book when you kind of posed this question, what if abundance could finally replace the model of scarcity that has prevailed for so long at colleges and universities? What if new technologies could allow us to understand the varied backgrounds, goals, and learning styles of our students and could provide educational material customized to their unique needs? What if we could deliver education to students via on-demand platforms that allow them to study whenever, wherever, and whatever they desire instead of requiring them to conform to the broadcast schedule of today's education model? As somebody in broadcasting, that really leapt out at me, but I think it's a really great picture of the way we do this right now, that if somebody wants to take my opera history class at Carthage College, right now, I mean, unless, you know, for some reason they've arranged something else, they have to show up in Johnson Arts Center 209 at 1:35 Monday, Wednesday, Friday, because that is when I am, in effect, broadcasting that class. And of course, that now seems like a very, in terms of watching television and programs, that seems like a really antiquated way of doing things. And you're suggesting that there is something equally antiquated about that so-called broadcast model when it comes to delivering education.
Exactly. I think, you know, we're comfortable with it, so I don't think we see the opportunity here. But imagine all the kids who would benefit from your opera history class who just can't show up at Carthage College, you know, at the time you're teaching it, or who might benefit from my class and can't show up in Pittsburgh at the time I'm teaching it. Broader than that, you know, what we know in the learning literature is that students all don't learn at the same pace. You know, some students take a little bit more time to grasp a concept. Some students, you know, grasp it more quickly or may have already learned it. In the classroom, I've got to move the class forward at exactly the same pace. So I'm trying to hit the mean of the learning rate, and I know I'm leaving some people behind, and I know some people are bored and could go forward faster. Wouldn't it be cool if we could develop a system that could serve the whole population, not just the middle?
Hmm. One of the things you touch about in terms of the reluctance of many of us in higher education, I will freely and honestly admit to being one of them that in some respects bridles at this idea, pulls away from it in some fear, self-serving fear, if you will. But one of the reasons why maybe that is understandable, perhaps even forgivable, is the fact that so much of our system of higher education has been in place and largely unchanged for such a long time. And I think it is worth spending just a moment just in a sense quantifying that, how long our system has been in place, and in comparison to so many other things in our world, in our life, in our society, that have changed sometimes drastically over that same period of time.
Yeah, a lot of this book was motivated by research my colleague and I had done in the entertainment industry, and a lot of that research was motivated by this wonderful quote in 2015 we had the head of home entertainment at one of the big six studios come and talk to our class, 2015. And my colleague asked him, are you at all worried about the threat that Amazon, Netflix, and Google might pose to your business? And he said, you know what? My business is different. The same six studios have dominated my business for the last 100 years. There's a reason for that, and that's not going to change. Right at the beginning of the pandemic, I heard the president of Ohio State University get asked almost the same question. And what I heard him say was almost the same answer. You know what? My business is different. The same 60 universities have dominated my business for the last 500 years. There's a reason for that, and that's not going to change. I mean, that's how old this system of higher education is and how established it is. It's perfectly reasonable to think that's never going to change. I just wonder whether we have a new set of technologies right now that could allow us to change it and could allow us to change it for the good, for the many students we know we're leaving out.
We're speaking with Michael D. Smith, author of The Abundant University, Remaking Higher Education for a Digital World. Since it is of paramount interest to you, we should spend some time talking about this notion of access and in particular, lack of access. And you tell a interesting story in the book about a famous author. I'm remembering the name, but a famous author who teaches a writing course at, I think, Princeton. And
Steve Levitt at Chicago.
Joyce Carol Oates. I just found it.
Joyce Carol Oates.
So teaches this course in Princeton, and in sort of describing how utterly impossible it is for almost anybody to get into this small class, this small workshop class, you give us a lot of other staggering numbers about the tens of thousands of applicants that Princeton receives every year and the relatively tiny number of students who are ultimately admitted to Princeton. So when it comes to trying to get into a place like Princeton, we're talking about a very severe limit of access, even to people who have the resources to even consider going to some place like that. Tell us about the bigger picture of lack of access to higher education, because, of course, not every college is Princeton.
Yeah, this is, I mean, the bigger picture. So this book, I started out writing it as a book about just technological disruption, which is what I know. About halfway through, it turned into a book about social justice. And one of the big things that you know, caused me to make that shift was there's an economic study done by a guy named Raj Chetty at Harvard. And what he found is if you're a kid born into a family in the top 1%, you've got a one in four chance of going to an elite college, highly selective college, 1 in 4. If you're a kid born into the bottom 20% of the income distribution, you've got a 1 in 300 chance of going to the same college. And what I've been saying to my colleagues is, hey, I'm trained as an economist. So I believe in the efficient allocation of scarcity. If we genuinely believe that rich kids just happen to be 77 times more likely to be capable of an elite education, we're doing fine. But if we don't believe that, and I don't know anyone who does, then this is a terrible way of allocating access to the scarce resource of higher education. And frankly, we ought to be ashamed of ourselves for defending. That's the, you know, like I've had three kids go through college, and over and over again, you see how the finger of wealth places its hand on the scale of access. If we're talking about access to BMW cars, maybe I'm okay with that, but not access to higher education.
To something as fundamental as that.
Desperately. Exactly. Something as fundamental to advancement. We ought to be desperately seeking ways to make access more abundant or more available to the people who are capable of it and deserve access to it. And what I see from my colleagues is we're protecting the existing system. I don't think we're doing it maliciously. I just don't think we've thought carefully about it.
Right. At one point in trying to explain the, let's call it the intractability of many in the current system, you say it at one point, in higher education, we tend to get confused when it comes to our model and our mission. You say our model has been so stable for so long that we have conflated it with our mission, and we therefore see any threat to the former as a threat to the latter. So what happens when we are clearer about those two? That is, what happens to this whole discussion when we make a clearer distinction between our mission in higher education versus the model with which we have delivered that education?
Yeah, the example I give in the book is the entertainment industry. I saw, and my colleague and I saw, the entertainment industry initially oppose technological change. You know, oppose Spotify, oppose Netflix, because they rightly saw it as a threat to their model. They saw it as a threat to their, you know, DVD sales, CD sales, and at some point we saw them recognize that their model is different than their mission, right? My mission as an entertainment company is creating great entertainment and getting that entertainment in front of an audience. It's not selling shiny plastic discs for $20 a pop. And I think it was that realization that allowed them to do all the amazing things they're doing in terms of, you know, creating their own platforms, Disney Plus, Max, Peacock, blowing up their business model to make this work. The parallel I see in higher education is, what's our mission, friends? If our mission is helping rich kids get a leg up in the job market, then yeah, we're doing great. But that's not our mission. If our mission is giving access to students from all socioeconomic backgrounds, we ought to look at ourselves squarely in the mirror and say, we're failing. And I hope that recognition of failure ought to give us the energy that says, I'm willing to blow up the way I've done it for the last 500 years because I care that much about making access to education abundant and available to people who today we're leaving behind.
So much of this is wrapped up in the advancements in technology that, as we've already talked about, have radically reshaped other parts of modern life, and you see higher education being changed and needing to change. And I think part of what your book argues is the folks in higher education, it would be wise for them to, in a sense, be in the driver's seat overseeing that change. I mean, and trying to safeguard the most important aspects of higher education if and when it tilts into this new model. Talk for a moment about the kind of research that you and others have done into the whole matter of delivering education through some of these technological tools that became, of course, indispensable during the COVID-19 pandemic. What were some of the things that you discovered in your research in terms of what was most effective, in terms of helping you see the full potential of some of these tools?
Yeah, one of the big ahas for me was my daughter was president of the STEMinist Club in her high school. So take feminism and combine it with STEM, and you've got STEMinism. And she wanted to take AP Physics in her senior year, and her high school says, you can't take AP Physics because you don't have AP Calculus. You can't take AP Calculus because you don't have pre-calc, and you can't take pre-calc because we're not offering it this summer. So I'm sorry. And that wasn't a satisfying answer to my wife and I. And because of the research I do, I knew that there's a platform called Outlier that offers an online calculus course that gives you credit at the University of Pittsburgh. And, you know, we basically made the argument that if our daughter passes Outlier's calculus class and gets credit at the University of Pittsburgh, are you really telling me that's not good enough for your high school calculus? Anyway, we won that argument. But the way Outlier's calculus class is taught online, it's taught by three different professors, and they each teach it in their own voice with their own examples. And you can choose to take the lecture from any of them, and you can even mix and match. And what I discovered is you know, my daughter immediately gravitated towards Hannah Fry, towards the one female faculty member of the three. And I was mentioning this to a colleague, and she said, "Oh, Mike, there's a bunch of research showing that in general, women perform worse than men in STEM classes, and that difference goes away when the class is taught by a woman." And by the way, the same thing is true for underrepresented minorities. Tend to perform worse, and that difference goes away when the class is taught by someone who can they can identify with. What I'm trying to argue to my colleagues is we know that's true, but we can't. It's really hard for us to deliver that in a traditional classroom. Look at all the ways that online education could allow us to let students match up with the professors that they really resonate with, mm-hmm. and how much better an experience that could give them if they, you know, if they don't come from the dominant gender or the dominant race.
Mm. You make an interesting point also that during COVID-19, when nearly all of the world of higher education had to move, in some respects, kicking and screaming, yet gratefully, into online delivery of our content, that unless there are exceptions that I'm not aware of, we didn't slash our prices as though we were delivering something that was just, you know, part of an education. I mean, we did the best that we possibly could under difficult circumstances to deliver a full, rich, abundant education, albeit in drastically different ways. And I think you're calling on us to not pull away from that, but to move ahead. One thing I appreciate about your book, go ahead.
I think every time I give this talk, about 20 minutes in, somebody, you know, a faculty member raises their hand and says, "Oh no, online education won't work." And we know that because the online education we delivered during COVID was a complete disaster. And what I try to say is, you know, if that's true, A, we owe our students a huge refund, right? You know, you can't on one hand say this was a disaster and yet I'm going to charge you full price. But B, recognize that we're going to get better with better tools, with more practice, with more training. Online education is going to get better. So mm-hmm. even if what we did during COVID wasn't as high a quality as what students would have gotten in the classroom, I think it could get to the point where it's even better, particularly for students who today we leave out of the scarce seats in our classroom.
Right.
That's the opportunity I'm trying to get my colleagues to see.
Sure. One thing I appreciate in your book that you acknowledge how painful this is, could be, would probably be in terms of some losses. And I appreciate the candor with which you include that in your discussion. You also talk about how you do not see traditional colleges and universities completely disappearing from the landscape, particularly venerable universities. There are still people who will want to go to Harvard, and there will always be a Harvard, to some extent at least. The last question, how do you see the landscape in terms of this new kind of higher education versus more traditional schools of higher education? Do you see them coexisting, competing with one another? Do you not see a dividing line between them? I mean, how do you imagine this future world of higher education?
I imagine one where higher education becomes much more modular for a lot of our students. You know, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Stanford, MIT, they're going to be just fine. I think Carnegie Mellon is going to be just fine, but I'm not 100% sure. What I'd love for us to create, though, is something online where if you don't have the opportunity or the resources to attend one of those schools, that you still have the ability to discover your talents and develop those talents and particularly signal those talents to the marketplace. Today, the way the marketplace treats us is if you don't have a four-year degree, you're probably not that smart. I think that's a very limiting way to think about this. And I'd love for us to develop other ways for students to demonstrate their skills in a way that employers can use in the hiring process. That's the shift I'm hoping for. It would have been tempting to call this book "The Death of the University." I don't believe that's true. And so what I'm trying to evoke in the abundant university is an alternate path, and one that has abundant access in contrast to the scarcity of the traditional university.
Right. One of the chapters of your book is titled The Unjust University: Why It's Hard to Foster Inclusivity in a System Based on Exclusivity. That and much more gives us a lot to think about in your book titled The Abundant University: Remaking Higher Education for a Digital World, published by the MIT Press. And the author, Professor Michael D. Smith from Carnegie Mellon University. Professor Smith, thank you so much for this book, and thank you so Greg, much for this conversation.
Greg, absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We'll spend the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show exploring the details of an interesting report that has just been released by the Environmental Integrity Project. And it's titled The Aluminum Paradox. Aluminum is something that has a very important role in a lot of groundbreaking work to make our planet a cleaner place. So, for instance, when solar panels are constructed, typically aluminum is a major component. Wind turbines, more efficient cars and other vehicles. But aluminum brings, in a sense, its own price tag, its own cost, its own environmental cost. And that is at the heart and soul of this report, which was authored primarily by my morning show guest, Nadia Steinzohr, a policy and research analyst with the Environmental Integrity Project. And in this report, they try to spell out some of the problems with aluminum and also try to point the way to some reforms that might improve the situation. We have Nadia Steinzohr with us to offer some further explanation about this report. Nadia Steinzohr, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks so much, Greg. It's great to be with you and have a chance to talk to folks in Wisconsin. And thank you for that very kind intro about the report. And yes, indeed, we are exploring the aluminum paradox that we're currently in nationally. And the Environmental Integrity Project has also laid out some really clear pathways to make sure that the production of aluminum is cleaner and healthier and then can play an even stronger role in a clean economy.
Before we get to the report, tell us more about the Environmental Integrity Project. I know you are a nonpartisan, nonprofit watchdog organization. Tell us when you were formed, under what sort of situations, and the kind of things that you have examined and explored.
Sure. The Environmental Integrity Project is a nonprofit organization based in Washington and Texas, as a matter of fact. And it is, as you say, a watchdog group. It was formed actually by a lot of former Environmental Protection Agency staff who were interested in seeing stronger enforcement of the nation's laws that were really developed to protect the health and well-being of communities. And there are really, you know, a few goals that the Environmental Integrity Project has. One is to really hold federal and state agencies and corporations accountable for the pollution that they cause and for failing to comply with the law, and also to really encourage local communities to get to seek those protections. And as this report and many other reports on different industries that EIP has done show, we are also very interested in just illustrating through credible information, objective facts about the impacts of the failure to enforce and the impact of different industries that are a part of our lives.
It's really intriguing to think about former employees of the Environmental Protection Agency being part of the Environmental Integrity Project. I mean, and it's just interesting to think about, first of all, the interest, of course, in these concerns that they would bring, but also a certain kind of expertise and experience when it comes to some of these complicated matters.
Yes, it was founded, you know, over 20 years ago by a former EPA official who worked in enforcement. And as you say, you know, he, Eric Schaefer, and the whole staff of EIP really bring tremendous talent and understanding of the complexities of environmental laws and their enforcement to protect the health and well-being of communities and our environment and our climate. So there's a great deal of expertise on both the legal and the research front at EIP, and I'm really proud to be part of it through this report.
We're speaking with Nadia Steinzohr. She is a policy and research analyst with the Environmental Integrity Project and lead author for a report called The Aluminum Paradox. So before we talk about kind of the problem with aluminum and the paradox that those problems present, maybe we can start even more basically with that and just talk a little bit about what aluminum is, and in particular, how we get aluminum, or the product that we call aluminum, and which gets used in so many ways. So just start with, if you would, aluminum 101. Give us the basics on what this material is, and maybe its primary uses.
Sure. Well, I would say that if you just look around, probably where you're sitting, if folks are in their homes or even in their cars, just look around and you'll actually see aluminum everywhere, whether it's, you know, as small as the beverage can in your hand or on your desk, all the way up. I've got a water bottle here that's made out of partly aluminum, all the way up to the car in your driveway and the appliances in your kitchen. Aluminum plays a very central role in our lives. Oh, our laptops, of course, the phone I'm talking to you on. So aluminum is an incredible, lightweight, durable, very flexible metal that can be used in a lot of different applications. It can be alloyed with other metals, and it is very recyclable. If handled properly and processed properly, it can be used over and over and over again. So it's really an amazing metal. So we're pretty excited about its prospects to play a bigger role in clean energy, in solar panels. It's a big part of solar panels, wind turbines, and is being used more and more in electric vehicles to sort of offset the weight of the batteries because it's so lightweight. So there's a really big role to play. But the issue that we have, and getting back to your question about 101, is that you can just imagine how much energy, water, chemicals, and land it takes to go from a rock that's mined out of the earth in many different countries around the world, and to take the minerals that are, you know, locked up in that rock, and then to convert it into a powder that can then be converted into a metal. And it's all along the way that they're just all of these substances and all of these processes and big facilities like aluminum smelters and refineries that end up causing a lot of pollution for people.
By the way, how long has aluminum been around? Do you happen to know, even roughly?
Well, there's evidence, stories, art, anecdotes going back hundreds of years about the use of aluminum, and that aluminum was even, you know, used by some emperors and kings as kind of a precious metal.
Wow.
And courts that used it for their fanciest dinners, you know, to have it as silverware and plates. It goes back a long time. But at different points in history, aluminum's fortunes have really taken off. And that would be, you know, around the dawn of aviation, the development of the automobile, and during the World War, you know, the different world wars, because it's used a lot in military equipment. But, you know, the process I just described of going from a rock in which aluminum is in a mineral form all the way to the beverage can on your desk or the door in your car, that process really took off in the 1880s when industrial scale development and production methods were developed. And so those methods that were developed in the 1880s are still the essential backbone of the industry today to create new aluminum. And they are the processes of converting this powder that's called alumina into metal, and also to turn the bauxite ore into the alumina powder. So those methods were developed in the 1880s, and since then it's really taken off. We saw another surge, you know, in the dawn of modern life with all of our appliances and everybody driving everywhere. And now we're seeing another surge in demand as we, you know, look to forming a cleaner economy. because of climate change and because of all the problems that we're facing. So it's kind of ebbed and flowed over time, but it's really since the 1880s that it's taken off on a very large scale.
Hmm. So in your report where you spell out kind of the environmental and health impacts of aluminum, and maybe we should say the creation of aluminum. I mean, a piece of aluminum just sitting there is not causing any trouble to the environment, but it's how we get there through every step of the process. That's really where the problem is. And your report cites environmental impact in all four of those major facets, starting with the mining of this thing called bauxite, which comes out of the ground and eventually becomes aluminum. What's going on in that mining phase that is of concern to you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So mining, you know, of anything causes problems because you're basically, you know, stripping away land, whether it's, you know, forest or farmland or anything else, and digging stuff up from underground. The bauxite ore contains aluminum in its mineral form, but it also has other heavy metals and such. But the real problem comes from the loss of the farmland and then the creation of a lot of waste product and dust. So you have communities in Guinea, and Jamaica is the major supplier to the U.S. So there are mines in Jamaica, and we cover that in the report, that, you know, where people are really having a lot of trouble with their respiratory health because of the dust, and the waste products are getting into their waterways, which is also causing problems. And so there's a big loss of livelihood and health in the communities where the mines exist. And in Australia, for example, which is the world's largest producer currently of bauxite, there's a tremendous loss of forest land and documented declines in bird populations. There are more trees that are stripped in the bauxite mining areas of Australia for the mines than even for logging. So it's pretty shocking what happens to the landscape and what also happens to the surrounding communities, and they're just kind of coated in this red dust. And then there's a lot of waste that's left behind because what's then shipped to refineries to be turned into alumina powder is after the rock's already been ground down. And so there's just a lot of sort of debris and waste products that are just left behind and can really threaten land and water.
Hmm. Once we have the bauxite, then it becomes crushed into this white powder that is called alumina. So we're getting closer to this thing called aluminum. What are the hazards? What are the hazards of this particular phase?
Yes, that's a great question. This particular phase has to be done in these very large industrial facilities or refineries. And there is one still left in the United States in Gramercy, Louisiana. And it's almost a sister industry to the mine in northern Jamaica that supplies the bauxite to it. So the bauxite comes and it has to be reduced and crushed further. And there's a lot of chemicals and water that go into that process as well as energy. And through a whole variety of these chemical processes, it then comes down to this very fine powder that's, almost like sand or cornstarch or something that's that pure and that small. And that's the powder that's then turned into molten metal. And the biggest, most obvious impact from the alumina refineries is the creation of something called red mud. And that's just these vast heaps of waste product that is also red, just like the bauxite is, and can really cover cars and homes and cause a lot of respiratory problems for people. The other issue is that there can be quite a lot of mercury discharged from alumina refineries, and that's causing problems in Louisiana and the waterways, as well as just posing a real health risk to the surrounding communities. Mm-hmm. That's the biggest concern. And the storage of red mud, I mean, there's just billions of tons of it all over the world, just kind of sitting at either old alumina refineries or current ones like the one in Louisiana. And there's actually another one that's been closed down, but there's just acres and acres of this stuff just sitting there and waiting, for proper closure and disposal.
Hmm. And it's one of those problems that if we are oblivious to it, it can grow to an extent where it's going to be really hard, even harder to deal with.
Exactly. There's definitely been no nipping the problem in the bud. Quite the contrary. It's just been allowed to accumulate and accumulate. And if mismanaged and not covered properly, can really leak into waterways and blow all over people and communities.
Right.
And that refinery in Gramercy, Louisiana, is in an area called Cancer Alley because they have so many petrochemical facilities and oil refineries and other kinds of industrial operations that the people there are already under tremendous pressure. So we were very sad and disheartened to see that the alumina refinery is actually part of that whole complex. It's not, you know, the only cause of the problems, but it's definitely part of the mix.
I think in some ways the most complicated of the four processes for us to understand is the creation of something called petroleum coke or pet coke. Why does this happen? Does this have to be done? And then what is the problem with it being done?
Yes, I'm really glad you bring that up because that's a part of the aluminum process that's really not talked about much because it is a feedstock. And EIP got really interested in this question because it's actually been pursuing a case that's based on the civil rights of a community in Port Arthur, Texas, that lives next to a calcining plant, which is a refinery where this petroleum coke is created, and it's called the Oxbow Port Arthur calciner. And the plant there, the real problem with it is it's taking petroleum coke, which is a distilled product from oil refining, and refining it even further so that by the end it's almost 100% carbon. But embedded in it is also a lot of sulfur. So it's all carbon with a bunch of sulfur mixed in. And when that petroleum coke is produced and also when it is released in the process of creating aluminum, it releases a tremendous amount of sulfur dioxide, which has a lot of health problems, respiratory, cardiovascular problems. It can really take a toll on the surrounding communities. And this plant in Port Arthur, as well as the other dozen or so around the country that create this calcined or highly refined petroleum coke, are causing a tremendous amount of problems for people. And the reason it's used as the feedstock, which is also why it's somewhat overlooked in the process, and it is the primary ingredient in the devices that are needed to smelt or create the aluminum. So they're called anodes, they conduct electricity, and it's those devices that have a lot of pet coke in them. And there's a new technology that we hope will come on the market that Alcoa and a couple of other companies have been developing for decades. Now they're saying we're on the verge of having them. And it's a different kind of device. It's a different kind of anode that would not have pet coke in it, and it would be carbon and sulfur free. So if the industry would really seize on that technology and that opportunity and adopt it, we could do away with a lot of the sulfur dioxide problems. But in the meantime, you've got these pet coke refineries that are just really highly polluting.
Right. And this all ends with the process of smelting alumina to convert it into metal where it can actually be used. And it sounds like that process as well is problematic.
Yes. So the U.S., as of about 25 years ago, had 23 smelters around the country. Today, primarily because of globalization and just the high cost of electricity and operating and not kind of keeping up with modern technology, there are now only 6 operating smelters in the U.S. And those 6 continue to pollute. They're very old. The youngest one was built in 1980, but they go all the oldest one is one in New York that was built in 1902. So, you know, they go back a really long way, and they've certainly been updated and retrofitted over time to some degree, but they're essentially really old facilities, and they are not complying with the law. There are many, many water and air violations occurring all the time. And we're really concerned that, you know, on the brink of a surge in the clean economy and with all of this tremendous opportunity to grow aluminum and to grow American jobs and to really see a surge in manufacturing, that the operators of these facilities have to clean up their act and really do a better job of reining in the pollution at smelters. Now, you know, I will say a big part of the puzzle, and that gets back to the paradox too, is the need for more clean energy to power these smelters. By our estimates, about 70% of the greenhouse gases coming out of the smelters is due to the electricity, and five of the six smelters in the U.S. Still run on coal plants or some oil and gas power that they get from the grids, but they don't run on clean energy, and that really needs to change. That's our number one recommendation, actually, is that if the states where these smelters are located could make a shift over time, we don't expect it to happen overnight, but if they could make a shift over time to cleaner energy, that would go a very long way to reducing emissions.
In the time that remains to us, what would be at least a couple of your other recommendations for confronting this aluminum paradox?
Yeah, so I've mentioned the clean energy shift for the smelters, and we've talked about you know, the need to change over to more modern technologies for production. And I would add to that, and this I hope would be of interest to your listeners, because there's a lot of what are called secondary production or rolling and forming mills for aluminum in Wisconsin and many other states. And we really see tremendous promise in that industry. There's a lot of investment going that way. The U.S. is the second largest producer of that type of metal, which is essentially made from scrap metal and recycled metal. And if we all did a really better job of recycling, and if industries like the automotive industry or the solar panel industry does a really excellent job going forward of stripping out the aluminum from used products and then remelting it, it could continue to create a lot of jobs and really help put a big dent in the amount of new aluminum that we need. So that's a big recommendation, too, to just really do a much better job in that direction to try to offset as much of this new aluminum from bauxite that we can. And then we need updated rules. We need updated rules that are, you know, in the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, and we hope that the EPA will take a hard look at the rules that are now decades old and update them to encourage the industry to modernize. And, you know, finally, there's all of these incentives come in now through the Inflation Reduction Act and some tax credits, and we really hope that aluminum companies will seize on those and take the opportunity to modernize and do a better job and clean up so that they can be part of the clean energy economy going forward.
If somebody listening wants to read this report for themselves, dig into it a little deeper, is it available to the general public?
Yes, it absolutely is, and we really hope people will read it. There's a several-page summary, which is kind of fun to read. It's got some graphics right at the front if you don't want to read an entire report, and it is called The Aluminum Paradox. It's available on the Environmental Integrity Project's website, which is environmentalintegrity.org. So just go to type in environmentalintegrity.org, and it will be there. The Aluminum Paradox, and we really hope people will read it and enjoy it and find it useful. There's a lot of resources in there, too, to just learn more about the role and the benefits of aluminum, as well as what we can do to make it even cleaner going forward.
Nadia Steinzohr, the lead author of this report called The Aluminum Paradox, a policy and research analyst with the Environmental Integrity Project. Thank you for joining me today. Thank you for your good work on this important issue, and best wishes.
Thank you so much, Greg, for having me and for your interest in the topic. Have a great day, and good day to all your listeners.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Nan Calvert pays her monthly visit to the program, and we'll have an important conversation about the damage done to our environment by plastics. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. We have sunshine right now, but we have in our forecast a 60% chance for showers developing by the afternoon. A high of 65. Rain is likely tonight with a low of 48 and a 50% chance of still more rain tomorrow with a high of 59. But sunshine in our forecast for Friday and Saturday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. NPR News.